Aloha, Paul. How are you today?
You know, I'm all right. I'm just okay today. You know, just a little feeling a little funky, trying to keep up with everything and just feeling like it's one of those days where I just need to dig a giant hole or something out in the ground. Out with some friends at the food forest yesterday. We got some more bananas in the ground, removed some bunchy top. Definitely had a chance to get covered in soil, but just not feeling satisfied, needing to just, you know, hurl my intentions at the creator of all the soil and, you know, lovingly, but just I need to pour myself back into that somehow. So how about you? Thanks for asking.
Let's have a date after the show. I think I could use something very similar, to tell you the truth.
Right on.
Yeah, so it's good. It's beautiful. The air feels pregnant with moisture, like maybe we're going to get something today, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Certainly had enjoyed the full moon experience of the weekend and moon actually entering Scorpio yesterday.
Ooh.
Finally. Or sun, rather.
Like me, remind me what that means exactly.
Sun entering Scorpio.
Okay.
It just means we've... at any rate, technically speaking, it did. Anyway, whatever that means. I'm not exactly positive.
Okay.
I know that we're at the end of the year.
If stuff wasn't working out, it's bound to change.
Yes.
There we go.
Yeah, something like that.
Good, good. And you told me about the magic of the mushrooms in and around your environment and how inspired you are by just that spontaneous energy of nature, which you probably didn't sow seeds of, but just came up on their own.
Exactly. It's been so beautiful. Rarely in my part of the island do we get enough rain for an extended period of time that the earth stays moist. And there was a day back there, it seemed like it was sunny all day, yet raining. And that's certainly just ideal. So as the mushrooms just started sprouting up all over the grass, everywhere, all different kinds, it made me feel like the biology of the land is good, that it's alive. It was very interesting, only that a friend came over this morning and was telling me she was having fungal problems on her papaya trees. And I thought, well, everything has its perfect balance. You know, there's a little bit of something that's good, and there's a threshold in nature where too much of it becomes too much, and some kind of natural control needs to come in and sort of manage it. So it's very interesting, especially that we're going to talk about micronutrients a little bit today, because the same effect for them.
Truly. Well, I'm grateful that you have an overabundance of seeds from time to time, and you sure have brought me a beautiful collection today, confirming the abundance of the land there.
Nice.
Where you're found. So thank you for that. Excited to bring them to the Community Seed Bank. Tomorrow is our open day from noon to 5. Feel free to come down and join us there at the Children of the Land, located right next to Papayas. We'll be processing all different kinds of seeds, and we're actually pulling seeds aside in advance of the December 1st celebration at the Food Forest. It's our one-year anniversary. And we are going to have a lot of fun and a lot of camaraderie and celebration, and the little bit of work that we'll do, but the huge impact of work that we'll do is we're all going to go off and plant seeds right in the soil. We need to reestablish a lot of ground covers. It's time to put in a lot of food-bearing legumes and edible cucurbits and all different kinds of things that we can just push right into the soil and make a huge difference without too much elbow grease being expended. So just a little advanced invitation for people to for the December 1 Food Forest anniversary celebration.
Excellent.
Yeah. So we always start the show with appreciations. Check. Now we can do our celestial session, and we look to the heavens for guidance, inspiration, and just those cues of maybe it's time to take care of a particular thing that I've been putting off. And today is probably no exception, so let's go to it. We're in the Hawaiian we're still in the second Hawaiian moon phase of Poepoe, or Anahulu. It's one of three divisions of the moon's month. So we're still at the tail end of the rounding or full aspect of the moon. And today's moon is Laaukulua. And Laaukulua rises on Kauai at 8:46 p.m. this evening, reaches its transit or its highest point in the sky at 3:30 a.m. tomorrow morning, and sets again tomorrow morning later at 10:53 a.m. on Thursday. 84% of the moon's face is illuminated. And we have the last quarter moon arriving on Monday. Laaukulua is the second of the Laau moons, good for planting mai'a, bananas, ulu, breadfruit, and other trees. It is also a moon recommended for harvesting plants to be used as medicine. Now, Laau means not only plant, we'll often hear it referred to that, but it also means medicine. And this speaks to the importance of plants in traditional Hawaiian medicinal practice, or lapa'au. And I have a short stanza here which tells us a bit more on that subject. The kahuna Laau Lapa'au had an extensive botanical, pharmacological, and medicinal knowledge of the available resources, which included an estimated 300 or more plants and ferns, both native and Polynesian introduced, as well as at least 29 animals, mostly marine creatures, and about 12 minerals, including palolo, clays, alai, red ochreous earth, and pa'akai, sea salt. These ingredients were prepared in a variety of ways and utilized to create a multitude of medicinal treatments. That from the HawaiianEncyclopedia.com. And thanks again to Hui Maui Ola for the Hawaiian moon information. I had the good fortune of meeting Kamaka on the phone. He's the new executive director of the group that puts out the Hawaiian moon calendar that I often refer to. And we've been talking about collaborating on raising our knowledge and understanding of the moon phases and how we can best share that knowledge with the community. So I'm excited for that collaboration that's coming up.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, from the biodynamic perspective, as I said, yesterday the sun moved into Scorpio. Today and tomorrow the moon is in Gemini. An air sign, making it a good time to work with flowering plants. And then during that on Thursday, we will reach our apogee. So we will start to head into the descending moon phase, which becomes the good planting times. So Friday and Saturday, the moon will be in Cancer, water signs, making it great for working with our leaf plants. And then Sunday through Tuesday, interestingly, beautiful how the Hawaiian calendar overlays so nicely this week, the moon will be in Leo, a fire sign, which makes it very good for fruit planting, including mai'a and breadfruit, according to the Hui Maui Ola. That's beautiful. So that's the forecast. Get ready to dig it up.
All right. Let's do it. So we are here to celebrate with you all about all manners of relationships, and while we love the relationships that we have with plants and plant people, plant geeks, there is a wider community celebration that I think people are still just floating a few inches off the ground. And of course, that is the second passage of Bill 2491, soon to be known as Ordinance Fill in the Blank. We're not quite sure. I spoke with Gary Hooser last night and said, What's it going to be called when it's all said and done? But it is no longer a bill. It is law. And Robin,
yeah,
share your feelings with us.
Excellent. I feel elated. I feel proud of everyone who worked really hard to do their thing. And I think that people realize in our peaceful way we're a pretty formidable force. And we're just not going to take no for an answer on this particular topic. So onward we go. You know, together, hand in hand with more people, I hope, and more people over time will understand the value of long-term thinking when it comes to our environment.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Big thanks as well, of course, to GMO Free Kauai, who've been regular guests on our program and have just been tireless and unceasing in their insistence that we focus on this issue. And now it is a banner that many people wave, but I really want to just honor them for starting it all out and just staying consistent up until and even through the victory on Saturday.
Sure, although I will just put in there, no time to rest on our laurels just yet. We really do have to see about enforcement and the follow-through on the bill. Also, good news on the Big Island. They passed Bill 113, which I believe is focused on a moratorium, is it correct, on new...
New GMO crops cannot be grown, and so the situation there, the exclusions are papaya. So GMO papaya can continue to be grown or be planted by someone who's never planted it before, whereas other crops, including corn, can only be grown by people who were growing it before this bill passed. And that's, I hear, only one dairy farm that grows GMO corn for silage. And so that would mean that even though corn is allowed by them, that GMO corn would not be allowed by any of the biotech companies who are currently not operating in Hawaii, on Hawaii Island, essentially. The cliffhanger there is now they're in the same situation that we were in. Their mayor needs to sign the bill, and it's not a foregone conclusion that that will be his choice. So there is an opportunity for folks who feel inspired that they want to testify, a simple internet search on Hawaii Bill 113 petition will lead an interested person to an opportunity to sign on to a petition, as well as some of the groups, the Hawaii Island GMO Free Group, and other things will come up there and other ways to be involved, or send your testimony directly to the mayor is a possibility. Wanted to say, too, so grateful that our county has a superb way for us to actually watch our council meetings.
Yes.
And for anybody who missed the saga, which really couldn't have been more amazing and dramatic, if you missed any of the chapters of the 2491 saga, the entire thing, it's very easy to access on the internet. And the way you can do it is just start in your web search under Kauai Webcast, one word, WEBCAST. The first link that'll come up in any of the search engines I used is the Kauai County Webcast Meetings. Click that, it brings you to the county page, and you'll find a search field. And if you just put 2491 in that search field and hit search, it'll give you every single one of the meetings from the very introduction. The July 31st huge testimony where several hundred people testified, and then all the way leading up to Saturday's decision.
Mm.
So it's captivating internet television that, I can recommend as worthy for people to see who's standing up in our community and, of course, the council members who are helping to lead the way.
Absolutely. Well, in printable news, other than that, I receive the Acres magazine every month, and I was pretty excited about this month because on the cover they talk about vinegar for weed control, which is a topic we've kind of talked about lightly here and there. Some people have had mixed experiences, and actually the article sort of says not necessarily a great choice. The potency of the vinegar that we can get commercially here at the grocery store is pretty weak, is not really gonna do the, it'll burn it down, but it may not kill the plant. So then you would have to go up in concentration, which then means, you know, sort of special ordering some kind of high concentration, which you have to be extremely careful handling. It's really will burn your skin and that kind of thing, and at that levels it's actually not so great for the soil, so that it will kill the weed but then makes other things have a hard time coming back around.
Right. So
looking like temporary measure, perhaps, if you're just trying to, you know, fluff out a movie set and make it look good for a few days, you can maybe burn the weeds down with it, but I don't think it is a long-term solution.
Now, you're making vinegars for the IMO, is that correct? Do any of those plant extracts you make actually become vinegar?
Some have vinegar, brown rice vinegar, used in them, and brown rice vinegar is considered to be a unique vinegar that, depending on what it's mixed with, it can actually be either an acid or a base.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got this mutability that seems to work well, and certainly in the concentrations that we're talking about in natural farming, which are often 1 milliliter per 1,000 mLs or 1 liter, we're talking about micro doses. So at that levels, vinegars aren't going to be harming your plants at all.
Right.
In fact, they strengthen the leaves. They make them stronger. They firm up the stomates, help with respiration and stuff like that.
things our weeds don't necessarily need from us. Yeah. They don't need any help.
Yeah.
Are there any applications that are made to the soil, to the land, in the natural farming process that limit weed growth?
I am sure there are. I don't know exactly what they are. I'm just beginning to start to learn the school of thought. And yes, I would guarantee that there are plants we can use to control weeds.
Right on. Well, I want to remind you that you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on KKCR, Kauai Community Radio, with your hosts Paul and Robin. And anything else from that Acres magazine, the new issue that came out? A beautiful shot of somebody holding a giant cabbage and,
sure.
and a feature story on training new farmers, yeah?
Exactly. At Green String Farm, a place on the mainland, and they're just having a great time. People are going. It's very similar to what Gary and Jillian created here at their seed-to-table program. Mm-hmm. And people are leaving, making good friends, and ready to go out into the farming community and, you know, become profitable selling vegetables here, which is great. Yeah. But actually, I wouldn't mind addressing a call that just came in. Someone wanted to know how to clean and dry and save seeds from lemon, basils, and Rosa Bianca eggplants. So can we take a minute or two to talk about, especially since that's the forte?
First of all, congratulations that you have a harvest of that. So you've done the first step, yeah?
Indeed, indeed. And I can speak to the eggplants to let you know that I find that when the fruit has turned yellow on the plant, that means it's fully mature. At that stage, I tend not to eat them much anymore. They have a bit of a bitter flavor. But that's the stage that you want to be collecting seeds from. Younger fruits are going to have immature seeds, so you may wind up with lower germination down the road unless you're harvesting a fully mature fruit. So get the yellow fruit. I chop it up coarsely in small amounts and put it in my blender, actually, with a large amount of water compared to the amount of fruit. And because I'm lucky to have a blender that has speeds, I can go way low. And it really just grinds the fruit up enough to let the seeds sink right out of it. And so if I keep it on low and then I can pour it through a strainer and easily start to lift off, and I just have a pile of seeds in the bottom of the bowl, which is really easy to work with. Then I will dry it on a soft cloth that's not linty until it's ambiently dry, and then onward through the drying stage with silica. These are all things that you could learn firsthand if you wanted to come down to the seed bank, if you have any time on Thursdays, as we mentioned. And at that point, they really need to dry with some drying gel for probably about a week, I'm guessing. And at that point, they could be stored in airtight containers and kept for probably a while.
Yeah. And that's the kind of easy way. But the really easy way is when that eggplant hits the ground, or sometimes even on the plant, they will rot. They'll putrefy and they get kind of liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that flesh kind of melts away, and sometimes you can even just find the shell of the eggplant and there's a whole bunch of seeds just sitting in it underneath the ground. So not as good as Robin's method if you want to be sure that harmful fungi have not affected or compromised the fertility of those or the viability of that seed. But if you're looking for the easy way, sometimes just letting it rot and then the seeds just come right out. Is one
sure.
way. As far as the basil goes, I was quite surprised when Ken Lindsay, a farmer from Mullawa'a who shares a lot of seeds at the seed bank, brought in a huge sheaf of sweet basil. And some of it was perfectly brown and dried, and some of it was still green, the shoots of flowers. And I thought to myself, surely this is immature. But I left it for a week. When we came back to the seed bank next week, it had all turned brown and beautiful, fully formed seed had dropped out. So I was surprised. A lot of times you want to be very careful one of the first mistakes we can make in harvesting any seed is that the fruit is not ripe yet or the seed is not fully developed. So I learned something, that the indication the plant was giving me that it wasn't ready was was not quite accurate. And certainly weeds often have this ability, and not to say that basil is a weed, but some plants have the ability, if it has immature seed, when you pull that plant out of the ground, that seed can still mature, which is what makes them weeds, is because sometimes the seed will still develop. But ideally speaking, it is a dry dehiscent seed, so you want to make sure that it is drying completely on the plant to the point where the plant would like to let go of the seed. And so you don't want to store it in a plastic bag. It's got to be, even a paper bag can cause mold in this time of year. So ideally would be either hang it, or we had quite a lot of luck just taking a 5-gallon bucket and cutting those flower heads off so that we stood it up like a bouquet, and there was enough airflow in that situation, and sure enough, a super harvest of seed.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Lovely.
We're going to move right on. We only have a few minutes, and maybe we only know a few things. Robin and I sometimes talk from experience, and a lot of times we're doing the research for you. So we're going to talk about Secrets of the Soil Builders right now. Maybe we'll return to it if we don't get quite to it by the time our special guest calls in at 12:30. But today we've decided to tackle one of the micronutrients, and that is copper. And I didn't know much about copper until I did a flurry of research. But tell me what you cropped up, Robin.
Well, first thing I learned with micronutrients, trace minerals, which besides copper, some of the other essential ones for plants are iron, chloride, manganese, molybdenum, and zinc. There is a perfect, and I mentioned this at the very beginning of the show, there's this point, nature's threshold, I think I'll call it for lack of better terms, but there's too little of something is not good, and the plant isn't thriving. And then
that would be a deficiency.
That would be a deficiency, exactly. And then you hit the sweet spot, the point where the plant really likes it. And then you can keep going if you keep adding, and you get to a toxicity point where now it's too much for the plant to be thriving. And what I learned is you really can't look at any one of these micronutrients necessarily in isolation, because the other trace nutrients that I just described will have a marked effect on the uptake of each other. So we can talk about copper a little bit, and I just wanted to sort of at first put it into that web of it all really is depending on lots of other things. So we don't want to really necessarily look at copper on its own, although it is very important for reproductive growth, and copper deficiencies are extremely common across the entire planet. And one of the most marked ones that stood out for me, I mean, there's deficiencies reported in 50 crops in 51 countries in the world, and wheat being one of them. And if there's not enough copper in the land, the wheat can't actually ear or make fertile seeds. It actually inhibits the reproduction of the plant to that point where there's actually then no edible grain out of it. So it's kind of serious. You know, you don't want to take a copper deficiency really lightly. Some of the plants that we experience here deficiencies with are citrus, pineapple, cacao, and coffee in our islands. And, you know, that's a good start.
That's a good start. Well, let me tell you what I found out. Let's see. Copper plays... I'm just going to go ahead and read some of the research.
Sure,
around
please.
Here. Sorry. So this, thanks to A&L Labs and their agronomy workbook, which Son Hadley uses over at One Song Farm. He showed me. I found it on as a PDF. And A&L Labs does soil testing as well as our College of Tropical Agriculture. A lot of people say that the results are better for organic systems than the results that we get from CTAR. I know CTAR is trying... has a concerted effort to have their analyses and suggestions more and more geared toward organic growers, but it really hasn't been that way for a while. So there are some holes there in terms of the understanding. But copper does play an important role in plant growth as an enzyme activator and in certain enzymes which function in plant restoration. It's very important, as Robin alluded to, in the case of the wheat in the reproductive stage of growth. and plays an indirect role in chlorophyll production. It also is involved in cell wall structure, photosynthesis, respiration, processes within the plant involving nitrogen. And now there are different things about, regardless of how much you have in the soil, it can be either be easier or more difficult for the plant to take it up. And actually, copper is bound by organic matter. So the good news there is if you have a copper toxicity, then adding organic matter, which is kind of a panacea of organic agriculture, you add organic matter, you have to fuel it, is going to buffer that toxic copper. I was looking at a soil test that we got over at the food forest, and it was showing 5 parts per million of copper. So it's unknown whether or not that's toxic. I was reading different things that gave me different ideas, but in speaking with Sun, he said his agronomist extension specialist there at A&L Lab says if you get over 5, that it could be toxic. And we were somewhere from 5 to 5.3 to 5.5 in some different soil tests we were doing. University of Hawaii's process of looking at micronutrients is more from a plant tissue analysis standpoint, and yet when I was looking at the research information, copper was not one of the micronutrients that was given sort of that sufficiency range. So I'm hoping to talk to somebody at the agricultural diagnostic laboratory at UH to find out maybe they just have it on another table somewhere. But it didn't seem that copper was being considered. Copper is also affected by soil pH. And so as pH decreases, if you have a very low pH, then their copper availability decreases as well. And it's also related to manganese, and heavy copper application might result in manganese deficiency, while the addition of manganese can release copper. One of the places copper might be coming from if you have a toxic solution is copper is used as a fungicide.
Yes.
And copper sulfate is very commonly used, and in any of the soils we have here, we often talk about the land use previous to the time when it was either your backyard garden or your market farm. There's a lot of things that could have been applied to the soil, pesticides and otherwise. And so toxic copper is a possibility.
Sure, and you know, it was commonly used to treat anthracnose on mango blossoms. That's the rot that will cause the blossoms to drop. And I know it definitely was heavily used here at some point. Well, just to wrap up before our next segment, one way to get healthy copper and zinc and actually iron as well into your soils is to recycle your grass clippings and your tree leaves. In fact, that's a pretty good way to get all micronutrients back into your plants. So not letting anything go to waste, all that stuff around the yard really does have a value and no sense in throwing it away.
Yeah. Indeed. Thank you. So copper. We love copper. Let's have not too much, not too little. And
just right.
Just keep doing that organic system. It seems to balance problems out if you're composting and taking care of the soil, as Sun always reminds us. It's going to take care of us. This is In the Garden on the Farm, and it's 12:30. I'm your host, Paul. She's your host, Robin. And she's our phone answerer, Aroshin, and you're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. And right now we're going to move into the final segment of our focus on brassicas, and this is the pest problem solved section. So we've looked at the family, we've looked at good growing techniques, and of course a subset of that is taking care of any problems we might be having. We're going to be joined on air by our friend from Oahu. This is Dr. Scott Nelson, Associate Plant Pathologist at the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture. And he knows quite a thing or two about problems that crop up for what he refers to as the crucifers, which is another name for the brassicas. So without further ado, Scott, are you with us?
Yes, Paul. And hi, Robin.
Aloha.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can
sure
hear you
can.
Just great.
Welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you.
How's it been over there?
Excuse me?
How's it been over there on Oahu?
Oh, a nice winter. Oh, we've got the south winds right now. Good black rot weather, I think. A little bit of rain.
Tell us about black rot.
Well, that's a disease of crucifers, you know, caused by the bacterial pathogen Xanthomonas campestris pathivar campestris.
Whoa.
And it can be a destructive disease of, you know, crops such as cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, collards, kale, Brussels sprouts, Chinese cabbage, turnip, mustard, radish, rutabaga, kohlrabi.
The whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah.
And I've heard that this can stick around for many years if it afflicts a garden or farm.
Well, it's persistent. You know, it can survive in the soil. You know, it's easily transmissible, and it's also seed transmissible. So even though you might think that you don't have it around, you can bring it in easily on your transplants or on contaminated seed.
Mm. And do you see major economic crop loss due to this disease?
I think, you know, the general statement is that you can probably have losses up to about 50% or even more in some cases. So, yes, you know, you can lose a lot.
Wow. And has the problem been getting sort of exponentially worse? Is it widespread throughout the Hawaiian Islands, or is it in isolated locations?
Well, I think it's widespread, but it'd be more severe where you have, you know, more rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
So in the drier locations, you know, where you're not irrigating with sprinkler irrigation, you won't have as big of a problem as you do in the more wet areas or where you're using sprinkler irrigation, because, you know, the pathogen is spread in part by splashing rainwater.
So can you maybe give us some tips on prevention techniques?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you should be able to recognize the symptoms, of course, which are typically V-shaped areas of necrosis that, you know, start at the margins of infected leaves and progress in a V-shape inward toward the center of the leaf.
And necrosis, that's a dead part of the leaf, yeah?
Yeah, right. It'll be turning brown, definitely, and it'll be a V-shaped. And there might be some yellowing around that V-shape as it progresses inward on the leaf. But, I mean, you want to start, if you can, with disease-free planting material. And so one way to do that is to use certified disease-free seed and transplants, which may be difficult to, you know, get in your area. But the other way would be to use hot water treatment for the seeds before you plant them.
Is that something that the university has been developing at all, any resistant strains to that particular disease?
I mean, resistant cultivars?
Yeah, yes. That's it.
We don't have a lot that's developed for this particular disease. I can't really cite one, but, I mean, depending on the genus and the type of crop, there are, you know, the range of resistance, you know, from slight to moderate, I would say, in some of them. So you can probably, if you want to do a Google search, you know, for seed companies, go to the crop you were interested in, maybe it's cabbage, and look for black rot resistant varieties that they offer. You could probably find some. But with the hot water treatment, you know, you want to be able to soak the seeds for cabbage, for example, for about 25 minutes at about 122 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, that's right on the edge.
Yeah, and that's right on the edge. But you want to put the seeds, you know, as a group in maybe a nylon bag or some type of cotton bag, and then soak them, you know, for about 25 minutes. But if you're looking at other crops like cauliflower or kale, 15 minutes at that temperature should be enough.
Mm-hmm.
So that will eradicate or kill the bacteria on the seed, or potentially on the seed, so that you know that you're starting with disease-free material. But if you see any of the symptoms on transplants, of course, they're going to be more minor symptoms probably, but if you see the symptoms, you probably shouldn't transplant them, because the disease spreads quite rapidly, you know, in rainy weather.
And what is the likelihood that the symptoms would be shown. It seems like such a great reason to start all of your crucifers in the nursery so you're not spreading it to the soil. But what is the likelihood that the disease is going to be visually symptomatic at that early stage of development, I wonder?
Well, if it's infected, you know, at the early stage, you'll definitely see the symptoms. There'll be small V-shaped areas that may be gray in color, you know, initially, and then turn brown on older leaves. But you may see some blackened veins a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the infections start, you know, at the hydathodes, which are openings at the margins of leaves, you know, natural openings. And so you want to look for the symptoms at the leaf margins. And if you see anything questionable, you know, even touching it with your finger and then touching a healthy plant, you could transfer the bacterium.
Right. Mm. Wow. Those pesky diseases. I want to give thanks to the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative, Dr. Russin Legata, Glenn Tevis. When we had our annual workshop this year, it was they who brought to our attention, because we specifically focus on seeds, the risk of this black rot, the fact that it can be seed-borne. And again, the treatment recommendations that you gave, I have the chart in front of me, hot water seed treatment protocols from Long Island Horticultural Research.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the same reference that you're looking at, but no doubt people could find it on the internet if they had a look for it.
Well, yeah, but you know, if you're looking at cabbage and you want, you know, a variety that may be tolerant of the disease, not necessarily highly resistant, but tolerant, I mean, there's varieties such as called Atlantis, Blue Dynasty, Bronco, Cecile, Ramada. Maybe broccoli varieties called Arcadia, Eureka, and Greenbelt have some tolerance to the disease. You could probably find them online, if not locally.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Thank you to the breeders as well that are working on this problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So another pest disease issue that I notice on my brassicas is if I cut the leaves off and the bit of leaf that's left hanging on to the main stem of the plant can start to turn brown and rot and sometimes infect the main trunk of the plant. Is that's very different from black rot, yes?
Well, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I think, you know, anytime you're cutting, I mean, you could be transmitting a pathogen on the cutting tool.
Sure.
But, I mean, I really can't say what that disease is that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically named the pathogen for that one, so
sure.
Need some more diagnosis there. But, you know, another common disease on the crucifers is called white rust.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that one before?
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. It's not really severely yield-limiting, but it's quite common in Hawaii.
It doesn't make them fly off the table at the market when they're covered with it, I wouldn't imagine.
No, but it's a, you know, disease of the leaves. And you'll see this white rust-like, you know, similar to other rust diseases of plants that are brown. This is more of a white color. And, you know, it's safe to eat, but it can reduce the market value and cause some concern for gardeners who see it. You know, usually you'll see it on the undersides of the leaves. When you turn them over, you'll see that rusty, powdery, not powdery mildew, but It's a white, clump-like rust.
And is there treatment for this?
Well, one of the best treatments is probably sanitation, mm-hmm. if we're talking about gardening, and that's just the removal of severely diseased leaves. And mm-hmm. then you put them in a plastic bag, and you can compost them in the bag or throw them away. You know, get them away from the healthy tissue. That's probably the best, you know, intercropping, you know, intercrop your susceptible plants with non-hosts, like maybe if you're growing some tomatoes that don't get the white rust, then you can intercrop the tomatoes with the cabbage or the other crucifers that do get white rust.
And these fungal problems are really showing that we have an imbalance in the system, whereas the black rot is a bacterial infection that can be spread even if you have good sanitation practices. I mean, short of, you know, using Purell between the use of touching every plant, but with fungal problems, there are larger scale corrective measures that we can take to increase airflow, like you said, sanitation, removing dead or dying leaves, and maybe looking at soil drainage issues, watering too late in the day, which, of course, if the sky is doing it, there's nothing we can do about that. But sometimes when those funguses come, we're either growing the wrong crop or we're just not... We're keeping the system out of balance in some way.
That's true, Paul. And one of the things we want to do as gardeners is be observant. And so sometimes we let the diseases, you know, go for a while, and we don't notice them. So by scouting around and looking at your plants, you can, you know, practice sanitation to remove the source of infection earlier, as early as possible, which then reduces the, you know, the growth of the population of the pathogen in the garden.
Absolutely. I can't say how many times I've been out there and I see something and I don't address it instantly and I forget. And by the time I might get back around there, it could be a couple of weeks, and then you have something that's just totally different on your hands.
That's correct, Robin. And with the bacteria, of course, there's so many more bacterial cells and there are fungal spores. I mean, the bacteria are so small, mm-hmm. such large populations in the infected leaves that, I mean, that helps to explain why it spreads, I think, more rapidly. There's just so many more infective spores.
Well, we're speaking with Dr. Scott Nelson, plant pathologist at the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources here in the University of Hawaii, and we're covering crucifers, brassicas, call them what you will, but they're the cabbages, broccoli, cauliflower, and mustard greens, Asian greens. What a wonderful family of plants that we can be growing, and yet sometimes we get pest and disease problems. Do you work with an entomologist there at the university that focuses on some of the pest issues, or do you cover some of those yourself, Scott?
Well, we have entomologists who cover the pest issues, and as far as insects go, yes. You know, we work with them. You know, there's so much knowledge in both areas of, you know, pathogens and pests that, you know, one person really can't have it all. So, yeah, we rely on them, definitely.
Do you find situations where a pest and a disease are often found together?
Well, normally a plant will have more than one problem, whether it's a nutritional imbalance, fungal pathogen, bacterial pathogen, you know, one or more insect pests. I mean, generally, that's the rule from my experience, is not just one thing happening on a plant. So it really takes an integrated approach, you know, to managing the system.
Indeed. You know, one disease that we often see, and of course not just on the crucifers, but on so many of our garden vegetables, is the powdery mildew.
Yes.
And it seems like we're getting back into that perfect time for that
time
this
of year.
Season.
Well, that one is really tough because it moves so rapidly. You know, it covers the leaf surfaces so quickly, and it causes severe damage. I mean, you can lose leaves, you know, rapidly. So, I mean, the main thing organically that you could do to manage powdery mildews is to use, you know, wettable sulfur as a spray on the leaves. It's very effective and very inexpensive, and you do it periodically. Or, you know, you can buy products such as Cali Green, which is, I think, potassium bicarbonate, or use the old home remedy, which is sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, and mix that with water, maybe a little bit of vegetable oil. So, I mean, we have some organic options for controlling powdery mildew that work pretty well. And if you're on top of it, as far as getting an early application of these products, you can manage the disease fairly well.
Nice.
Otherwise, I mean, sanitation is not going to help you very much, although it will help a little bit. It's just a very rapidly moving disease,
right.
Probably more rapidly moving than black rot or white rust.
So would you spread those sulfur and other is that a preventative medicine? You even put it out before you see a speck of it, or it's not worth maybe the time and energy until you see that very first occurrence?
I would not use it until I see the powdery mildew forming on the leaves, and I would spray it right on the leaves. You know, the label recommendation on how much to use will be on the label, usually maybe one or two tablespoons, or I think per gallon at the most. And then when you're spraying it, you want to keep shaking the container, agitating that suspension, so because the sulfur drops out of the suspension, falls to the bottom, and so of the container. And by the time you go to the bottom at the end of your spray, I mean, you're going to be very concentrated, and you could burn the plants with it.
I know that the crucifers are so high in sulfur to begin with as plants. Is spraying sulfur going to leave any sort of a persistent odor or flavor on the crop?
Well, it will leave a persistent odor and flavor, so you should wash it off, definitely, before consuming it, definitely. You will get sulfur particles deposited on the leaf, and that is what kills the pathogen.
Right, right. And just plain water will wash it sufficiently, though?
Well, won't get all of it, but, you know, it will wash it, a lot of it off of there, definitely. I mean, how else are you going to control powdery mildew? I mean, you have the baking soda or the potassium bicarbonate, which also works, but one of those two, I think, is what you have to use as a gardener. Mm-hmm. To control powdery mildews. Otherwise, you're not going to get any control aside from what you do with sanitation.
Right, which, as we know, can get really out of control really quick. So, Doctor, I was wondering if you're still doing your Plant Doctor app, and if you want to talk about that a little bit to our listeners.
Okay, Robin. Yep, everyone's welcome to download an app, either from the iTunes or from the Google Play, and it's called The Plant Doctor. And I think there are more than one app, you know, called The Plant Doctor. So this one that I have is was produced by Adelante Consulting. So you'll see this Adelante Consulting is the company that developed the app. And it's a free download, and basically what it does is ask you to provide a little bit of information about the situation, not much, and also take a couple of photographs with your smartphone. You press a button and it submits it to me, and then I'll reply to you as quickly as I can with my diagnosis and, if you want, some recommendations for managing the problem. So it's been pretty widely accepted. I think about 40 countries and about 41 states in the U.S. You know, people are using it, and people in Hawaii are using it also.
And do you have a team of people who answer the questions, or is it all on your shoulders?
It's all on me. I mean, I do it.
Wow. Well, I've just downloaded the app myself. I'm looking forward to sending you pictures of this horseradish plant that we planted up last year, and it's got a funny kind of a thing going on the leaf, so I'm looking forward to getting some feedback from you.
I look forward to receiving it. I mean, usually I respond within a few hours. I mean, it could be the next day, but, you know, sometimes within a few minutes, depending on, you know, if I'm at my computer when the request comes in.
Of course, and so you cover all kinds of, I know last time we got to speak with you, we talked about bananas, so you're able to help diagnose a wide range of different crops, it sounds like.
I am able to do that by and large because of, you know, I've been here about 22 years and have been able to see a lot.
Sure.
But, you know, 22 years ago, I definitely could not do it.
So specifically on the Hawaiian Islands here, so this is such a great resource.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think it's useful for people. I'm not guaranteeing an accurate diagnosis, but I'm, you know, pretty sure that I get most of them correct.
Well, thank you so much again for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge with us. We love your publications online and an opportunity to have a personal consultation via your Plant Doctor application for smartphones is pretty awesome. And look forward to sharing the journey of unwinding our problems with pests and diseases on a future program if we'll be lucky enough to have you again.
Well, thank you, Paul and Robin. You know, it's a never-ending battle, these pests, and I'm glad to just lend whatever help I can. And I really appreciate the chance to talk a little bit today.
Excellent. We appreciate you so much taking the time to be on the show with us today, too.
Okay. You're welcome.
Talk with you soon.
Okay. Aloha.
Thank you so much, Dr. Scott Nelson from CTAR, plant disease specialist.
More than you wanted to know about problems.
Right. But with solutions for each one of them. So
yeah.
Give thanks that College of Tropical Agriculture is willing and ready to give us some organic options for plant for disease control, and of course choosing the right varieties and balancing your system, but then things like sulfur and other solutions that are out there and available for us are pretty awesome.
Sure, all going to keep us on our toes.
Indeed. I want to jump into a few announcements just to make sure we get them out there. We have an important meeting coming up, Smart Meters Exposed. The filmmaker from the documentary Take Back Your Power is going to be here on Kauai this week. Two opportunities to see the movie in regards to the true effects of the smart meters that KIUC has installed in many homes around the island, risks not only to the people who live in those homes, but to people who live in the neighborhood, invasion of privacy, so many issues that we all need to become aware of. Saturday, November 23rd, a showing at 6 p.m. at the Aston Aloha Beach Hotel, and followed by a talk as well. Sunday, November 24th, 6 p.m. movie, 7:40 talk at Kahili Mountain Park. And for more information, see Smart Meter Free Kauai on Facebook. As well, there's a benefit concert for our brother Chad Pa. His baby soon to come is going to need some assistance. And a concert will be held at the Tahiti Nui Restaurant and Bar in Hanalei, 7 p.m. this Saturday, November 23rd, 2013. The medical expenses for the child's wellness is going to be pretty massive, and we really need an outpouring of assistance for ensuring the baby's safe delivery and recovery from pretty serious complications that could be due to pesticide exposure. So a special call out to the In the Garden on the Farm listeners to be there at the benefit concert this Saturday, November 23rd at Tahiti Nui. Three bands are performing: Kahala Na Opio In Season, which is Chad Pa's band, Sean Carrillo, and tickets are available at the door. As well, we want to let you know about a great workshop coming up at the Ke Kaha Community Garden. And this is a worm bin vermiculture workshop happening this Saturday, November 30th, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Ke Kaha Community Garden on Aukuu Road. If you want more information, 631-4982. And this is with Ned Self of the Wiki Wiki Worm Ranch, who kind of fell off our radar, and I'm really glad that he's resurfaced with the worms and going to share his expertise on that. What an easy, fun, rewarding way to make incredible quality soil as to partner with the worms. Yeah,
super.
I think that's what I've got for announcements.
Yeah.
How about you, Robin?
No, I don't have any more.
All right.
Except for our final segment of the day, I think, as we're winding up. I want to do Fresh Picked, what's happening at the farmer's market right now. Beets. Beets are delicious and good for you. There are lots of different varieties. Sometimes at the market you can find them, the Cylindra, which is a long cylinder one, the Chioggia, which is the Italian red and white kind of checkerboard beet, also very delicious, Touchstone Gold or Detroit Gold, a nice, beautiful golden beets. My personal favorites for the home garden are Detroit Dark Reds. I think they are just the stellar backyardia variety. Most of the red beets that we find at the market are going to be probably Red Ace or an F1 variety, because and if you're a commercial grower, as you know, the commercial growers who are listening to us right now, you kind of want your crop to mature at one time, turn the field, you know, keep it all moving, whereas the Detroit Dark Red has this great quality of kind of ripening slowly, coming on a little bit at a time, which is really great when you want to just bring in five of them to the kitchen every day for several weeks. It's pretty nice. The tops, some people are afraid of beet tops because they have some oxalic acid in them. And I want to...
More so than the root.
More so than the root does.
And is it okay to eat beet roots raw, shredded, or is there an oxalic acid issue?
Sure. If I put in a little disclaimer that I'm not giving you medical information here or anything, certainly things in moderation are just fine. I think I don't know anything that's wrong with raw beets. I'm sure if you did too many of them, maybe something could come up for you. But the tops are really high in vitamin A, the stems, they're really nutritious. So you can destroy the oxalic acid with just light heating. So a quick steam or throwing them in the stir fry, and then you don't rob yourself of such a great part of this plant. There's lots of vitamin A, folate, lots of B vitamins, and I just want to give you a quick little primer on how to pick nice beets at the market. You want them to be firm, nice tops, big, healthy, although there's nothing wrong with eating a squishy beet. They actually get a little bit sweeter when you're purchasing them from the market. You want them to be nice and freshly harvested, nice fresh tops. And then a quick little serving suggestion for me that I've been doing lately, because I love that beets and oranges come in around the same time. So beets and oranges with some sliced onion and black olives dressed with a little olive oil and vinegar is just absolutely delicious.
Is that waiting outside for us right now?
I wish.
Oh,
no, not at all. But
right on.
At any rate, that's wrapping it up for our show today.
Indeed it is. And we want to let you know this has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, myself, Paul, herself, Robin. We'd like to thank our guest on the show today, Dr. Scott Nelson. That's Scott with one T. And if you check him out with Scott Nelson Sitar, you will find an amazing selection of research articles and other knowledge that he's brought together for us here on Kauai and in the Hawaiian Islands regarding pests and plant, or rather to say diseases of plants. We want to encourage you to stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy's in the House. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the land of the life. With the life of the land, rather, that is, that gives us life. Aloha, Kauai.